KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Immigration agents have more latitude to arrest people across the country. Churches, schools, and hospitals were off limits for immigration raids. How are the rules changing now? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. How do Palestinians relate to a new U.S. administration? I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President Trump took office just after a ceasefire in Gaza. The broader conflict continues, and we will get a Palestinian perspective this hour. Also, how does an investigator of the January 6th attack respond to the president's pardons for the attackers? And who's the choice to lead the Department of Veterans Affairs? It's Wednesday, January 22nd. This day in 1973, the Supreme Court established a right to abortion, which lasted until another ruling in 2022. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. There's no indication that immigration authorities have started major raids to detain migrants in the U.S. illegally. But the Trump administration says federal agents can now go into places previously off limits to remove migrants. That includes children's schools, hospitals, and churches. It's part of Trump's executive actions on immigration. That includes his move to end birthright citizenship, a right protected by the U.S. Constitution. New Jersey and several democratically led states are suing over the issue. New Jersey's State Attorney General Matthew Plotkin says birthright citizenship is settled law.
It's been upheld by the Supreme Court multiple times. This is, until Monday night, not something that was ever contested by a president who signed an order that was extraordinary, unprecedented, and upended the rule of law.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. President Trump's executive actions on energy also call for boosting resource development in Alaska. Republican leaders in Alaska are praising these, but Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports environmental groups are pledging to fight the president's actions.
The order covers nearly every Alaska land use controversy this century. It calls for new oil leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and roads across protected federal land to help logging and mining. It's exactly what Alaska's all-Republican congressional delegation wanted. But Alaskans who advocated for these protections are seeing years of work erased. Conservation advocates are ramping up for lawsuits. As for Trump's order to restore the name Mount McKinley, a new poll by Alaska Survey Research found Alaskans, by a wide margin, favor the mountain's current name, Denali. For NPR News, I'm Liz Ruskin.
President Trump has also issued another executive order to dismantle all federal diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Any federal employee involved in DEI programs has been put on paid leave immediately. Stocks opened higher this morning as President Trump's pick for Treasury Secretary moves toward confirmation. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 115 points.
Treasury nominee Scott Bessent won a measure of bipartisan support in the Senate Finance Committee, which voted 16-11 Tuesday to send his nomination to the full Senate. If confirmed, Bessent will play a leading role in pushing the president's agenda on taxes, tariffs, and other economic policies. Trump has suggested February 1st could be a start date for stiff new tariffs on goods from Canada and Mexico. Canada is a major supplier of crude oil to the U.S. Retail gasoline prices have already jumped 4 cents a gallon in the last week. Stock in Netflix is up after the video streaming service announced better-than-expected financial results. Netflix is also raising prices by between $1 and $2.50 a month.
NPR's Scott Horsley. It's NPR. Israel has launched a new operation in the occupied West Bank, with arrests and deaths reported among Palestinians there. But about 50 miles away in the Palestinian Gaza Strip, a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas is holding for the fourth day. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports.
From the southern city of Rafah to the edges of northern Jabalia, the Gaza Strip lies in ruins, the result of more than a year of war and sustained Israeli airstrikes. Palestinians are able to see now what's left of their homes in areas Israeli forces have withdrawn from. But there's little reprieve here. Entire neighborhoods have been leveled, turning cities into gray mounds of rubble as far as the eye can see. Gaza's health ministry says more than 47,000 people were killed by Israeli fire in the war. Local health officials say they've recovered around 150 bodies from the rubble and decay of different parts of Gaza since the ceasefire began Sunday, and they estimate more than 10,000 bodies remain missing under the rubble. Aya Batraoui, NPR News.
There are three new elected members of the Baseball Hall of Fame. They include former Seattle Mariners star Ichiro Suzuki. He first rose to fame in his home nation of Japan. Also included are pitcher CeCe Sabathia and closing pitcher Billy Wagner. Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer has died at his home in New York, according to his wife. He was 95 years old. Pfeiffer worked for years for the Village Voice, but he was best loved for illustrating the beloved children's book, The Phantom Tollbooth. I'm Korva Kuhlman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. When a reporter asked President Trump on his first day in office if he's confident the Gaza ceasefire agreement will hold, he didn't skip a beat.
I'm not confident. That's not our war, it's their war, but I'm not confident. But I think they're very weakened on the other side.
Hours after taking office, Trump overturned Biden administration's sanctions on Israeli settlers who have committed violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. And soon after, Israel carried out a major military operation in the West Bank, killing 10 and injuring 40 others. We're joined now by Deanna Boutu, a Palestinian-Canadian human rights lawyer and former peace talks negotiator. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Leila.
Thank you for being here. So with this ceasefire in place between Israel and Hamas, a fragile ceasefire, a temporary ceasefire, Israel yesterday launched what it says were counterterrorism raids in the occupied West Bank to target militants. Does this risk the ceasefire agreement?
Yes, of course. And I think that that was the entire purpose of Israel doing this. Look, I don't think that obtaining this ceasefire agreement was without a price. In other words, I think that Trump put some conditions on Netanyahu, quite the other way around. Netanyahu put conditions on Trump saying that he wants to have everything from the sanctions on the settlers removed to being able to have a free hand in the West Bank. And so it's not at all surprising that we are seeing this massive raid inside the West Bank. And this is because Netanyahu doesn't actually want to have a ceasefire because, for him, continuing the attack on Gaza keeps him in office longer and keeps the spotlight away from him and instead keeps focusing on Gaza instead.
Now, of course, Israel says this was about going after militants in this area. President Trump, as you pointed out, was partially credited for facilitating the ceasefire agreement, but given and then is quickly reversing sanctions, lifting the U.S. freeze on 2,000-pound bombs going to Israel, and his remark that this is, quote, not our war. Do you think the ceasefire will hold if the U.S. ends its involvement in the deal, and what happens with future aspirations for Palestinians and a state?
One of the things that's really important is for people to understand is that this could have ended under Biden with a simple phone call, because the fact that Israel gets its weapons, most of its weapons, from the United States. So a simple stopping of transferring these weapons that are being used to carry out war crimes could have been done under Biden, but he instead chose not to. So the question is whether Trump is going to continue that arms sales, and it sounds as though he is. So the issue becomes whether the United States is going to remain involved, or whether they're just going to say that genocide can continue as usual. But on all of this, and this is, it's very important to note that you know, Israel, when it's going into Palestinian places, it's actually going into Palestinian homes. It's terrorizing these people, and people do have a right to protect their homes. The issue here is that because Israel has been given such a free hand, this is why you see Israel operating the way that it's operating now. It does not want a ceasefire. It wants to continue to carry out its attack on Gaza.
And I will point out, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, call this a genocide. The International Court of Justice, it's the basis of the case, but it is something Israel and the United States still deny. You know, inside Trump's circle, people have started to weigh in on the future of Israel and the Palestinians. Yesterday, Elise Stefanik, Trump's nominee for U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, said she believes Israel has a biblical right to all of the West Bank, views held by far-right ministers in Israel. What do you think that means for a future Palestinian state?
Their entire point is that they want to ethnically cleanse Palestine, and they're going to do whatever it takes to ethnically cleanse Palestine. The fact that we're now seeing these people who are ideological, who actually believe in ethnic cleansing, is terrifying as a Palestinian.
Diana Boutu is a Palestinian human rights lawyer and a former peace talks negotiator. Thank you for speaking with us and being on the program.
Thank you, Leila. Thank you.
President Trump's administration is rolling out its immigration actions day by day.
The federal government is broadening the number of people targeted for deportation and widening the locations where agents may arrest them.
NPR immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo has been following all these developments. She's in our studios. Jimena, thanks for coming by.
Good morning.
Okay, we've heard things the administration is saying, and gradually we're finding out how far they will go. Just a few weeks ago, December 16th, an advisor to the president was on NPR and was played a prediction about, quote, businesses being raided and, quote, kids not in your schools. And Mary Louise Kelly asked Jason Miller what he thought.
Jason Miller, is he wrong?
And I chuckle not because I'm taking the issue lightly, because it is such a bat, you know what, insane comment for this gentleman to make.
So dismissing the idea of people vanishing from schools, what are we learning now?
Well, the administration has now cleared the way for arrests in schools. The old rule said that schools, as well as places of worship, healthcare facilities, and a list of other areas, were off limits to arrests of people suspected of being without legal status. Mm-hmm. Now the acting Secretary of Homeland Security has rescinded those guidelines, which the Trump administration says limits law enforcement from doing its job. My colleague Brian Mann spoke with Bishop Matthew Hyde, who leads the Episcopal Diocese of New York. And Hyde disputes the idea in the administration's announcement that criminal migrants were, quote, hiding in schools and churches.
This ministry of sanctuary is central to who we are. Our congregations and our service programs welcome everybody. This is what our faith calls us to do.
But we don't know yet how immigration enforcement agencies are planning to ramp up their operations.
Okay, so we'll keep watching that to see how far it goes. What else is the administration saying about immigration?
The department also issued two notices to start the process of implementing some of Trump's executive actions.
Okay.
One includes phasing out humanitarian parole programs. This includes the program that granted permission for certain people from Nicaragua, Cuba, Haiti, and Venezuela to be in the U.S. It's not really known what will happen to the hundreds of thousands of people currently living with humanitarian parole. This also accelerates a Biden-era decision to not renew the legal status of those under the program. Another action set in motion is restarting full implementation of Remain in Mexico. This was a program from Trump's first term that required migrants to wait in Mexico while their asylum claims were being adjudicated in the U.S. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum told reporters yesterday that there needs to be a conversation with U.S. federal agencies.
I appreciate the one thing you said. You said one of these moves about humanitarian parole
accelerates a Biden decision. Mm-hmm. Biden's administration was also deporting people. This is a thing the United States does under any administration, but the terms are changing. And you mentioned when you were on the program yesterday that some people are suing over the new rules. Who else is suing now and why?
The main target of the lawsuits continues to be Trump's executive action that aims to reinterpret the 14th Amendment. This is the amendment that grants citizenship to nearly every person born on U.S. territory. It says all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens. Trump wants to change this widely understood meaning of those words and make citizenship dependent on the status of one's parents and whether they're here in the U.S. legally, illegally, or on visas. A group of 18 Democratic state attorneys general, including from New Jersey and California, joined the legal fight to block the move.
Got it.
And a coalition of civil rights and liberties groups also filed a separate lawsuit.
And Pierre Jimena-Bastillo, thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Many thousands of homes burned in the Los Angeles wildfires, but some are still standing, untouched. Is it luck, or was it something the homeowners did? NPR's Lauren Sommer went out with an inspection team looking through the debris to study what can save a home.
Steve Hawks is a forensic analyst of sorts, not for crime scenes, but for buildings.
Let's take a trek up here and see what we find.
We're in a neighborhood hit hard by the Eaton Fire in Pasadena, and Hawks works for the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. It's a nonprofit research group that studies why buildings burn, funded by the insurance industry.
Oh, right here. Here's the damage.
This house has a detached garage, which is only a pile of rubble now. Hawks checks a satellite image of what this looked like before the fire and sees that the building was surrounded by green.
There was probably really dense vegetation right behind there.
Mm-hmm. Which likely led to the ignition of this structure.
That's a common one Hawk sees. Vegetation needs to be trimmed back from a building. The detached garage didn't make it, but the house did. It's still standing.
We've seen it on every fire that we've ever been on. Homes do survive these high-intensity wildfires.
It could be there was a sudden shift in the wind. But Hawk says there are some proven things this homeowner did right. For one, the garage is about 30 feet from the house.
If this garage was closer, it could have led to the loss of this structure because of the amount of heat coming off of the garage.
There is a burn mark on the side of the house, though. Hawks kneels down to inspect it, where something flammable was clearly sitting next to the outside wall.
So we had embers travel in here, land, ignite this item.
But the siding on the house resisted those flames because it's made of stucco instead of wood. And there's more. The roof is fire resistant. Even the attic vents under the roof line are covered in a fine mesh. If those openings are too big, embers can go right into a house and start a fire from the inside.
So if you take your common golf tee and try to poke it through the mesh, if it goes through, it's too big.
This is a newer home, so these fire-resistant materials were required by California's Wildfire Building Code for homes in risky areas. Most other states don't have codes like this. But he says even older homes can make some of these upgrades, like removing flammable plants and items within 5 feet of a house.
We're not going to be able to keep fires out from every community under every situation, so we need to prepare communities, and that's at the parcel level.
When many homes do this, it makes an entire community safer. Lauren Sommer, NPR News, Pasadena.
This is NPR News.
the next fresh air, Pamela Anderson. She became a pop culture phenomenon in the late 80s, in part because of her role on the series Baywatch. But there's much more to her than that. She received Golden Globe and Screen Actors Guild Award nominations for her role in the new film, The Last Showgirl. A documentary about her was nominated for an Emmy. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at Cunard.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Enrique Tarrio is out of prison. President Trump pardoned the founder of the Proud Boys, who was serving 22 years for seditious conspiracy over the January 6th attack back in 2021. Trump also pardoned Stuart Rhodes, founder of the Oath Keepers, similar charges. In all, the president pardoned or granted clemency or ordered charges dismissed for more than 1,500 people, including people convicted of assaulting police with bear spray or flagpoles or police barricades or baseball bats, a metal crutch, revolving door. Our next guest is Tim Hafey, lead investigator for the House committee that examined January 6th. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Steve.
So you did all this work. A lot of people were convicted by law enforcement authorities at the same time. Did the president succeed in erasing all your work?
Absolutely not. Look, our work was meant for history. We created the definitive account of what happened at the Capitol. And that matters, Steve, regardless of whether there's a short-term legal consequence for the people that were convicted of crimes at the Capitol. There's a long-term historical significance of what we did.
Now, I just want to work through a little bit of this. You say a short-term legal consequence. One of the president's explanations for all these pardons was that some of the sentences were, quote, ridiculous and excessive. We did mention a 22-year sentence for the founder of the Proud Boys, Enrique Tarrio, who wasn't there because he was in custody at the time, but was convicted of seditious conspiracy of planning for this attack.
Yeah.
Was 22 years too much?
No, look, the system works. The system is regular people, jurors that decide guilt or innocence beyond a reasonable doubt, and judges that take into account a lot of factors in sentencing. There was a range of culpability among the people convicted of crimes at the Capitol, from misdemeanor, trespass, and disorderly conduct, to the most serious, the use of force, the advocacy of the use of force to disrupt the lawful function of government. That's seditious conspiracy. There's no distinction in these pardons between the least and the most culpable. They were blanket pardons for everyone.
I want to note that during the presidential campaign, when people had an opportunity to vote on this, the Trump campaign did make a distinction. The now Vice President J.D. Vance said on television, there's video, if you committed violence on that day, obviously you shouldn't be pardoned. He felt that people who had been peaceful protesters should be pardoned. But if you committed violence, you shouldn't be pardoned. When you look at the list of people who were pardoned, do they include people who committed violence?
Yes, they do. The president did not take that advice from his now vice president and others. And members of Congress have just since the pardons come out and said that they disagree with pardoning people who committed acts of violence. The other thing I want to point out, Steve, is that no one here has been prosecuted strictly for their political beliefs or for speech. Everyone, from the least culpable misdemeanants to the most culpable felons, have been convicted for actions taken, things that they did, not things that they said.
Do you have some sympathy for the people on the lower end of the scale here who maybe would say that they were part of a protest, didn't really realize what was going on, got a little bit out of hand? Sure, they entered the Capitol, but they were not among the leaders, did not really understand. And there have been plenty of defendants who've said that sort of thing. Do you have some sympathy for those pardons?
No, look, again, the system factored that in, and those misdemeanants either did not get jail time or were not, they weren't given the 22-year sentences like Enrique Tarrio. Again, everyone prosecuted Steve, went beyond speech and took an affirmative act to either, you know, step across bloody stairs or go through broken windows into the Capitol. There's a level of culpability that everyone crossed that justified criminal charges in the eyes of the Justice Department and ultimately in the eyes of jurors and judges.
Do the pardons encourage more political violence in your view?
Yes, I fear that they do. If you accept the premise that criminal sanctions deter criminal conduct, then it's a short step that the excuse of criminal behavior through these pardons actually encourages criminal behavior.
Got to ask about one other thing here. Some Republican lawmakers have said, I disagree with these pardons. They've criticized the president on this, but many of them have then said, what about? What about Biden's pardons? What about Biden's preemptive pardons of people who were accused of various things, including members of your committee? You've got a preemptive pardon. Does that action by the president make it harder for you to make a clear case that Trump's pardons are wrong?
Yeah, the preemptive pardons, fundamentally different animal. They are reflections of the statements by the president that he will investigate the investigators, that they're not the excuse of violence like the pardons of the J6 rioters.
Tim Hafey, lead investigator for the House January 6th committee. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
The Episcopal Bishop of Washington addressed President Trump directly during yesterday's prayer service at the National Cathedral, calling for mercy on those afraid. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose reports.
Donald Trump and J.D. Vance attended the service, sitting in the front row with their wives. Bishop Marianne Buddy addressed Trump directly during her sermon.
In the name of our God, I ask you to have mercy upon the people in our country who are scared now.
Trump signed executive actions just after his inauguration Monday, cracking down on immigration and declaring that there are only two genders, male and female. But he pointedly addressed those issues.
There are gay, lesbian, and transgender children in Democratic, Republican, and independent families, some who fear for their lives.
Also afraid, Buddy said, are those who pick crops and clean offices who may not be citizens or have the proper documentation, but are not criminals.
They pay taxes and are good neighbors. They are faithful members of our churches and mosques, synagogues, wadara, and temples.
During Trump's first term in office, Buddy took him to task on a number of occasions, including when he stood outside an Episcopal church near the White House and held up a Bible after law enforcement used chemical agents to disperse racial justice protesters. Following the sermon at the National Cathedral Tuesday, Trump told reporters he didn't like the prayer service.
I didn't think it was a good service, no.
He added the cathedral could do much better. Republican U.S. Representative Mike Collins from Georgia posted on social media that the Episcopal bishop should, quote, be added to the deportation list. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Evacuation orders have been lifted in parts of LA as the city continues to battle wildfires. But for those with houses still standing, it's unclear if returning home is safe.
Part of our concern is making sure what we're coming back to is a place that's not just whole, but safe and stable for our family. Like, not every toxin is obvious.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Police groups are expressing disappointment over President Trump's pardons and commutations for those charged with crimes stemming from the January 6th attack at the U.S. Capitol. NPR's Martin Costi reports.
The National Office of the Fraternal Order of Police issued a statement, along with the Police Chiefs Association, the IACP, saying they're discouraged by recent pardons by Presidents Biden and Trump of people who've harmed police officers. The statement does not specify the cases of Trump supporters who assaulted police officers at the Capitol, but David Carter, a former cop who researches policing at Michigan State University, says those pardons are on officers' minds.
They are disappointed, and I think it's more of a reaction of, are you kidding me? Why would you do that?
After taking office on Monday, Trump pardoned some 1,500 people convicted of crimes committed at the Capitol in January 2021 as protesters tried to stop the certification of Joe Biden's presidential victory. Martin Costi, NPR News.
A winter storm that dumped heavy snow across the deep south is being called a once-in-a-generation event. New Orleans got hit with nearly 10 inches of snow yesterday. More than 8 inches fell in Pensacola, Florida. Several inches of snow piled up in cities such as Baton Rouge and Houston. This is NPR News from Washington. Crews in Southern California continue to move closer to containing the two largest wildfires burning near Los Angeles. Containment on the Eaton Fire near Pasadena is up to 91%. The Palisades Fire between Santa Monica and Malibu is now at 68%. Red flag warnings are in effect today across the region, with the National Weather Service warning of wind gusts reaching 60 miles per hour. Israel's ceasefire with Hamas in Gaza is holding. This is day 4 of the ceasefire and hostage release agreement. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv says as that truce holds in Gaza, Israel has started a new military operation in the occupied West Bank.
The Israeli military has turned the Jenin refugee camp essentially into a closed military zone. Jenin is an urban area that's home to many Palestinian families and kids. It's also long been a militant stronghold. Israel says this is a counterterrorism operation aimed at strengthening security in the West Bank. But some Palestinians in the West Bank, like 53-year-old Walid Amira, say it feels like the war in Gaza is shifting over to them. Of course the war is coming here, he says. The Israeli government wants to prove something to their people, and the West Bank will become the place to prove it. Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, called this new operation a, quote, significant shift in Israel's approach to the West Bank. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The president's nominee for Secretary of Defense is once again facing allegations of alcohol abuse and misconduct.
Yeah, Pete Hegseth endured a round of questions about his past as well as his qualifications, and his nominations made it out of a Senate committee on a party line vote. The full Senate has yet to vote, and now his former sister-in-law has added her own views. She submitted an affidavit to senators saying Hegseth caused his ex-wife to fear for her safety.
Unsurprisingly, the affidavit is now public. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh is among reporters who obtained copies. Deirdre, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so what in this document adds to what was already known?
This is an on-the-record signed sworn statement from Hegseth's former sister-in-law, as you noted, Danielle Hegseth. She was married to his brother, Nathaniel. And she states that she was asked to provide the statement by the top Democrat on the panel, Jack Reed. Senator Reed told me last night he made the request for the details because he didn't think the FBI background check on Hegseth was adequate. Danielle Hegseth says, in her personal opinion, Pete Hegseth is, quote, unfit for the job. She says her former sister-in-law, Samantha, Hegseth's second wife, who he divorced, feared for her personal safety during their marriage. She often hid in a closet. She said Samantha had a plan about texting her a safe word or code word that meant she wanted someone to fly to Minnesota to help her. Danielle Hegseth also said she personally witnessed Hegseth intoxicated, yelling in her face. She told the FBI that Hegseth abused alcohol numerous times over the years to the point of actually passing out during a holiday gathering.
Well, what does Hegseth say about all that?
Well, NPR reached out to his attorney, Tim Parlatore. He has not responded. But Parlatore told NBC, which first reported on this affidavit, that Samantha Hegseth, this ex-wife, never alleged any of abuse and actually signed court documents acknowledging there was no abuse. And she affirmed that as part of Hegseth's background check. He maintained, Parlatore, that Danielle was, quote, an anti-Trump far-left Democrat who was divorced from Hegseth's brother and never got along the family. He said she has an axe to grind. In Samantha Hegseth's case, she told NBC in a statement there was no physical abuse, she wasn't going to comment on her marriage, and she didn't have representatives speaking on her behalf. It's worth noting that during the public confirmation hearing, Pete Hegseth was pressed about previous allegations about excessive drinking, inappropriate behavior, which he denied.
In a broad sense, said they were anonymous allegations and so forth. I guess the key question here involves Republican senators. How are they responding to this?
You know, they're standing behind him. I spoke with several last night after this affidavit became public. Most said they hadn't read the document, but they questioned the timing, the motivation. Hegseth's nomination is on track for a full Senate vote later this week or over the weekend at the latest. I talked to Armed Services Chairman Roger Wicker. He told reporters he had grave doubts about Danielle Hegseth's account in the affidavit, but he also admitted he hadn't read it. He said he was planning to review it, but he dismissed it as political. So far, no Senate Republican has publicly said they're going to oppose Pete Hegseth's nomination. With the 53-seat majority, he can lose three Republican votes and still get confirmed. He's not likely to get any support from Democrats, but he's not going to need them. Right now, he has the votes.
Yeah, I guess we should note the political context as well, that President Trump has demanded this nominee, and conservative groups have campaigned pretty strongly and threatened primaries and so forth against Republican senators. Deirdre, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR's Deirdre Walsh.
Former Georgia Congressman Doug Collins is President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Veteran Affairs, a cabinet agency second in size only to the Pentagon. Collins answered questions from the Senate VA committee yesterday. Amid the blizzard of partisan politics as Trump took office, NPR's veterans correspondent Quill Lawrence reports this hearing was civil and bipartisan.
Doug Collins is a former Georgia congressman. He's also a colonel in the U.S. Air Force Reserves, and he put his service front and center at his hearing before the Senate VA committee.
These are my dog tags. They're a reminder, just like every other veteran who served, that we're part of a bigger unit.
Collins referred to his service again when asked about the PACT Act, the massive expansion of VA benefits under the Biden administration, treating toxic exposures going back decades, such as Agent Orange in Vietnam, or noxious burning trash pits like the one in Balad, Iraq, where Collins deployed as a chaplain.
I'm an Iraq war veteran. I understand burn pits because I slept next to one for many months. I understand this generation that went for time and time again, deployment after deployment, in a different way than we'd seen many times before in our past wars.
Collins served three terms in the House and was known more for his loyalty to President Trump than for any involvement in veterans' issues. He's never led an organization a fraction the size of the VA's 400,000 staff and 1,300 health facilities. Critics say that's why he's unqualified. But at the confirmation hearing, he went into the weeds on VA policy and smoothly parried senators' questions.
My issue is I'm going to take care of the veterans. That means that we're not going to balance budgets on the back of veterans' benefits. We're not going to do that. We're going to put the veteran first.
That was his answer to questions about President Trump's suggestions of cutting government spending and his announcement of a federal hiring freeze. But with that announcement less than 24 hours old, Collins could not answer specifics about how it would affect VA's many job vacancies, even urgent ones for doctors, nurses, and mental health care. Washington Democrat Patty Murray pushed him on the seemingly endless quest to update the VA's electronic health record, which has now spanned four presidencies. Collins vowed bipartisan cooperation.
We're going to have to work together. The finger pointing's done. It's time to get it done for one reason and one reason only. As I said earlier, the mission is the vet.
Senator Murray quickly pivoted into the more controversial issue of the VA providing abortion services.
I have cared deeply about our women veterans and that they have the services they need. So I want to just ask you, do you believe a veteran who lives in Texas, who has been raped and becomes pregnant, should be able to get abortion care at her local VA?
Since the Supreme Court ruled that states could ban abortion, the Biden VA has provided abortion care nationwide. But Collins said he believes a 1992 law prohibits VA from offering abortion services.
I will tell you this, we will be looking at that issue when I get in there to confirm that the VA is actually following the law.
The other most serious disagreement on display was about VA care versus private health care. The Trump administration supports allowing veterans to choose either, but leaning on private or community care is a growing drain on the VA's budget. Collins said there's a happy medium.
I believe you have a strong VA as it currently exists and have the community care aspect. I believe you can have both.
How to have both is the biggest veterans policy disagreement in Washington. So many Democratic senators asked Collins to pledge not to privatize veterans' health care that Republican Tom Tillis half-jokingly asked Collins to pinky swear he wouldn't do it. Collins held up his pinky and obliged. But President Trump has vowed to slash government spending, and the VA is a perennial target. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
A sociologist says elites focus too much on social justice symbols, like removing Confederate names from schools, instead of helping victims of injustice. Next time, here and now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Christopher Walken has appeared in more than 100 movies and TV shows, and he says one role haunts him. Walken told Will Ferrell his life was ruined by the Saturday Night Live sketch that Ferrell wrote called More Cowbell. Walken plays a producer who keeps demanding a band add more.
I got a fever, and the only prescription is more cowbell.
This remains as famous as any of his more serious roles. I have a fever, too, and the only prescription is more Ning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. 60 years ago this week, a song told of escaping the drone of daily life by spending time in the heart of the city.
You can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, so go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown.
Downtown topped the charts and made British singer and songwriter Petula Clark a star. She's now 92 and spoke with A. Martinez from her home in Geneva.
I want to start with when you first heard of this song that English composer Tony Hatch wrote.
I was living in Paris at the time, having lots of hit records in French and Italian and German. And Tony said, you know, you really should be recording in English too. I said, oh, well, you know, and I'm fine the way I am, and we have to find the right song. You know, he said, well, I've started writing this song. I said, let's have some tea. I'll go in the kitchen, make some tea. You play it on the piano. And so Tony played the melody of Downtown. And I said, that is one great tune. And 2 weeks later, we recorded it in London. And the rest is history, really.
Maybe you know some little places to go to where they never close. Downtown.
What do you remember about that time in the mid-60s when Downtown became such a big hit? I mean, it was number one in the United States, number one in Canada, Australia. I mean, it was just a worldwide sensation for you.
Well, it was very exciting, of course. But we didn't realize we'd recorded a monster. You know, you don't realize that. You know, really, the Beatles had opened the doors for British performers. You know, they were the spearhead of this British invasion, as they call it. And I remember the first time I sang Downtown in front of an American audience was in New York. I walked on stage and people just stood up and cheered when I walked on the stage. And it was like, what? You know?
How important of a moment was this for your career?
Well, it was a huge moment, but it was also very difficult because, you know, I had this big career in Europe. We had two small children, and suddenly America was saying, you've got to get here, you know, and it actually complicated my life quite a lot, but in a rather marvelous way. When you record a song, you're not aware of how it's touching people. Some marvelous stories I've met over the years, some guys who were fighting in Vietnam, and they would say to me, your song helped us, gave us courage to go on.
You had a U.S. tour in 2017. That was when you were in your 80s, traveling and sleeping on a tour bus. Petula, I mean, what keeps you going?
Oh, I just love doing it. That's really the reason. We're planning to do a concert in London as we speak. It's the audience that does it, that contact between what's happening on stage and what's happening in the auditorium. There's a kind of communion that happens, and it's almost a spiritual experience. I love it.
That is singer Petula Clark. Thank you very much for sharing your voice with us.
Thank you for asking me.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Where's California going to find the wood and the people to rebuild after the fires?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab knows that investors want control of their financial future. That's why when it comes to wealth management, Schwab is dedicated to giving investors more choices. More at schwab.com. And by Glassdoor, announcing the best places to work in 2025 based on anonymous reviews from real employees. See who's hiring at glassdoor.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. Some welcome rain is in the forecast for Southern California this weekend, although warnings for high winds that can fan flames remain into tomorrow. The wildfires have killed 28 people and destroyed some 14,000 structures. Officials are focusing on housing the tens of thousands of people displaced, but for the weeks and months ahead, Marketplace's Justin Ho looks at the challenge of rebuilding at this scale.
First of all, the rebuilding effort is going to face many of the same challenges that the entire home construction market's been facing for years now. Shortages of skilled labor and building materials, including electrical transformers. Also, expensive construction loans.
Even though Federal Reserve interest rates have come down, we still see lending rates for builders around 10 to 12% right now.
That's Jim Tobin, CEO of the National Association of Home Builders. He says home construction in California comes with its own set of challenges, too.
You're talking about the most expensive market to build in the country anyway. Layers of regulations, delays, the high prices of properties.
One silver lining is that lumber prices have actually come down in recent years, says Greg Kuda, CEO of Westline Capital Strategies. But he says the possibility of new tariffs on Canadian lumber could push those prices back up, especially if demand for lumber surges at the same time.
When you actually have the demand to rebuild, prices could be substantially higher a year from now.
But there are some unique factors that could help usher along the recovery process. Last week, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed an executive order meant to speed up the rebuilding effort by suspending certain permitting requirements and environmental reviews.
It will be easier to get projects approved. It will be easier to get the hookups necessary for utilities.
That's Daryl Fairweather, chief economist at the real estate company Redfin. She recently looked at how fast homes got rebuilt after previous fires in California.
Looking at wildfires in California that happened in the 2010s, we found that new construction bounces back fairly quickly.
That said, people who've lost their homes will still have to decide whether the costs of rebuilding are worth it. Fairweather says many will likely say no, especially if they get an offer from a developer to buy up a damaged property.
Like, people are going to find that the offers that they get from developers are going to be quite large and maybe bigger than what they're getting from their insurance company.
That's because that land is valuable, and builders know that redeveloping it could be pretty profitable. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
I see Netflix stock is up 11% after its fall into winter. Results revealed it added 19 million subscribers, and it's set to raise prices by $1 or $2 a month, depending on your tier, which will delight shareholders and dismay customers. The NASDAQ is up 1.3% after that. The S&P is up 0.7%. The Dow is up 73 points. The Trump administration is prioritizing the shutting off of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Federal employees who work in DEI offices are being put on paid leave today. Our Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us now. Nancy?
Yeah, the Office of Personnel Management sent out a memo on this yesterday, David, and it says agency and department heads have to send out notices by 5 p.m. Washington time today telling DEI workers they'll be put on paid leave effective immediately, and the DEI offices they work for in federal agencies and departments will be closed. Those workers will eventually lose their jobs or be reassigned.
And federal contractors, too?
Yeah, the White House issued a fact sheet on that, and it says DEI preferences in federal contracting and spending will end, and the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs is now barred from pushing contractors to balance their workforces based on DEI.
Now, some of this will end up in court.
These executive orders could be challenged in court. I noticed the executive order says DEI programs should be terminated, quote, to the maximum extent allowed by law. And civil rights groups have been gearing up for court challenges on some of these executive orders.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Clear Channel Outdoor. Clear Channel's nationwide network of billboards and data-driven solutions help businesses big and small build brand awareness and influence consumer behavior. Learn more at billboardsforbusiness.com. And by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals who want to join an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
Among the many executive orders signed by the president is one pulling the U.S. out of the WHO, the World Health Organization. The U.S. is its biggest funder by far. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more.
President Trump first tried to pull the U.S. out of the WHO back in 2020, but ran out of time when he lost that election. Jennifer Cates at the health policy nonprofit KFF says when he won this time,
this was widely expected.
Still, she says a U.S. withdrawal from the WHO would be a big deal for the agency.
The funding obviously would be a big hit for WHO. The expertise being removed is another.
The U.S. contributes about 16 to 18% of the WHO's budget, far more than any other country. Jesse Bump at the Harvard School of Public Health says the U.S. also shares a lot of knowledge, staff, and data.
And if it's not sharing its own information with others, and it's not receiving information from others, public health disasters that don't have to happen will happen because those capacities aren't there anymore.
It'll take a year for the U.S. withdrawal to go into effect. The WHO says it hopes the administration will reconsider. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
And ESPN, part of now ESPN Bet, operated by Penn Entertainment, wants people to have what it calls the talk with the gambler in the family. It's a new campaign to urge heart-to-heart conversations along the lines of set a budget for your sports gaming and don't be a knucklehead. Online, ESPN.com/smartplay will have further resources because those risks include ruining yourself and your family. ESPN is partnering with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas' International Gaming Institute with an approach it says is based on behavioral science. ESPN quotes the director of that institute saying the promo spots will, quote, accentuate the positive by encouraging healthy habits. Being a better bettor is not just about knowing when to take risks. It's also about knowing when not to. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
Stay away from me.